Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Hi, Imani.
Hi. Haven't seen you in a while.
It's been so long.
I know. I was trapped on San Juan Island taking the infamous fish class and literally had no time for anything but that specific science.
We've missed you, but most importantly, I've missed you.
I'm so happy to be back. It's so nice to see your lovely face and be excited about this episode.
Yeah, I'm so excited. It's really interesting. It's only been like a few weeks since we've recorded, but since our little mini break, we've had so many people reach out again. Like, where are you? Here's an article I'd like you to look
at. We're back.
We're back. We're back, everybody. We're back.
I promise. We missed it just as much as everyone else did.
I know. Seriously, this is like my therapy hour, just learning about sharks and geeking out about sharks with very yes. cool scientists.
Yes, me too. Today we have Dr. Niela. We are super excited to talk about this paper. Would you be willing to just introduce yourself to our sharkies, tell us about where you are and what you research?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Yuri Niela. I'm a postdoc at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. And I study sharks for the last almost 10 years now. And recently on my PhD, also at Macquarie Uni in Australia, I was looking at the effects of climate change on shark distribution and behavior along the east coast of Australia.
Super cool.
This paper was so cool that we looked at today. I'm really excited to ask you all the questions. We've had a lot of like telemetry papers, I think, on our podcast, but none that are specifically about looking at how climate change can impact migration behavior. So this is a first for us.
Yeah, I'm very excited to learn some things.
Well, I'll go ahead and just jump into the summary. So today we're breaking down Dr. Niela's paper, Forecasting Intraspecific Changes in Distribution of Wide-Ranging Marine Predator Under Climate Change. And this was published in 2021. So the summary for you all is climate change is causing animal distributions to shift in response to changing temperatures. Typically, shifts in these behaviors are evaluated at the species level, but in this study, Niela et al. Studied behavioral shifts at the individual level. They investigated 115 tiger sharks, Galeu cerdo cuvier, from 2002 to 2020, and evaluated how behavior and distribution differed between sex and maturation class, which means they're either juveniles or adults. With this long-term data set, Niela et al. Modeled how behavior and distribution may continue to change in tiger sharks to 2030. So they started modeling and predicting how that behavior would change. And they included environmental factors and predicted occurrence of potential prey. Generalized linear and additive models revealed that water temperature change, particularly at higher altitudes, was the factor most associated with shark movements. Females disperse southwards during periods of warming temperatures, and while juvenile females preferred a narrow thermal range between 22 and 23 Celsius, adult female and juvenile male presence was correlated with either lower or higher temperatures, which is interesting. We'll definitely break that down. During a La Nina, sharks move towards higher latitudes and use shallower isobaths. We'll jump into what isobaths are as well. An inclusion of predicted distribution of their putative prey significantly improved projections of suitable habitats for all shark classes compared to simpler models using temperature alone. So they really included a lot of variables here. Tiger shark range of the east coast of Australia is predicted to extend about 3.5 degrees south towards the east coast of Tasmania, particularly for the juvenile males. This study will assist in evaluating the consequences of climate change to the species distribution. All right, so there was a lot in there. Super excited to break this down with you. But I wondered if we could just start off by briefly overviewing how climate change can impact distribution and marine predators just generally. Why would climate change impact predators for those that might not be as familiar with the topic?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, when you think about temperature, for example, sharks, right? Most species, they cannot control the internal temperatures. And because of that, like they depend on certain temperature gradients so their physiology can work fine, okay? So that's pretty much, imagine like if I like to live around 22 degrees Celsius and now this 22 degrees Celsius is not fine, is not found north anymore, so that's moving south. So I'm gonna start moving south because I need that temperature range so my my body can work fine. Okay, so it's not like it's not that like these animals, they know specific places and they don't know the geographical boundaries that we do. Okay, so they follow all of these signals. Okay. So that's for temperature. And for example, oxygen. So climate change is affecting the amount of oxygen that we have, especially in the deeper layers of the ocean. So imagine like you're a predator and you're following your prey. So you're hunting. Okay. So imagine when you exercise, you start to breathe more intensely because you need oxygen, right? So if you don't have that amount of oxygen necessary anymore, so you might start avoiding these deeper layers in the ocean, okay? So tiger sharks, for example, we've recorded dives of like 900 meters in the ocean. That's quite a lot.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I study seven gills and they go to about 300 meters and I thought that was really deep. So.
Yeah, like they don't remain in the 800s for very long. But they can go down there. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. I was a bit surprised in the introduction that you stated that the males have a higher level of philopatry than the females. And I wondered, isn't that usually the opposite? Isn't usually that females will have really high sight fidelity or they'll continue to stay in one spot, but the males will move around?
Yeah, that's right. Like that's usually the case in most species. But yeah, we're finding evidence not only in the Pacific, but there are some other papers suggesting that for the Atlantic as well. So in tiger sharks, we believe that the males usually remain in these particular areas and that connectivity is more associated with females moving into different regions. Okay, so especially, so that's not only for sharks, tiger sharks in Australia. So that's been found for the Atlantic as well.
Wow, interesting. I'd also never heard of that. So before we get into your materials and methods, you use data from 2002 to 2020, which is a really long data set. And I'm not sure that many of our listeners would fully understand how hard it is to get a data set that is for such an extended period of time. Did you originally start implementing tagging in 2002, or was this kind of a continued collaboration on shared telemetry data?
Yeah, so I moved to Australia in 2018, and I started working with people from many different institutions, so different universities and different government agencies. And these guys, they have been tagging tiger sharks there since 2002. So we're talking about different projects and different methods of tagging sharks, but pretty much they all were collecting the same type of information that we were interested in, which is location. So we were interested in looking at where tiger sharks go and what influences that. Okay, so I was first contacted by people from the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries. So Dr. Paul Butcher, he contacted me saying, look, we have this great data set on tiger sharks and we want to be interested in including that in your type of analysis, so looking at the effects of climate change. So when we think about looking at the effects of climate change, you can't really do that by simply looking at, for example, a year of data. Okay, so right. we need historical data so we can compare. Okay, so what were these animals doing back in 2002? And what did they do, for example, in 2010? And what did they do in 2020? So yeah, it is quite impressive, but I was fortunate enough to connect and start collaborating with these other people that had these data from prior to 2010. So these guys from the James Cook University at the Australian Gold Coast. So they were tagging sharks back in 2002. So, and they were happy to start collaborating with us. So that was actually the product of this great collaboration.
Right. Were all of these people, right, who've been tagging since 2002, were they also collecting similar climate data that you wanted to use in comparison? Or did you have to go elsewhere for the climate data, like temperature or oxygen or chlorophyll?
So they were actually tagging the sharks. Okay. So the shark data was all collected very similarly between 2002 and 2020. And the environmental data I used was pretty much from remote sensing. So we used satellite data. And the reason for that is that, for example, the data loggers that were in the water, they changed, like they were in different depths, different locations. Okay.
Right.
So to standardize that, I decided to use remote sensing data. So I can create and set some parameters that are going to be exactly the same for the entire study period. So I used remote sensing data for this paper because of that.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I feel like something that our listeners might not totally understand is how rare that can be to have such a long data set of a single species in a single location. Most sharks do not have such a long data set. There's over 500 species, and we do not have anything like that type of robust data set for most species. So to have access to so much information is just so unique and really cool to really evaluate how climate change is affecting a really important apex predator in Australia. So you touched on this, but you said a lot of the different scientists that are within this collaboration have different types of tags that they used. And I wondered if you could just touch really quickly on a couple of those tags that were used, like the spot tags and the PSAT tags. We always tried to talk about what different types of tags are used when we talk about telemetry, because the different tag types can just be so diverse and different depending on what you're looking at. So can you explain a little bit about the different tags that were used in your methods?
Yeah, sure. So we use acoustic and satellite transmitters. Okay, so the three different types of tags that we used, they can be divided into these two big groups, okay? So acoustic and satellite. So when we talk about acoustic tags, we're talking about putting a transmitter in a shark, and that transmitter has to be detected by another equipment that we call acoustic receivers. So that's pretty much, in Australia, we have this big collaboration called the Integrated Marine Observing System, which is IMOS. So IMOS is this network of people who work with acoustic telemetry, and everyone puts their receiver data into this network. So what that means is that, for example, imagine I'm studying sharks in Sydney, okay? And say I have five receivers in the water, and I tag my sharks around here, and every time one of my sharks are detected in one of my receivers, I will know exactly which shark was detected there and when that happened, okay, to the nearest second, which is very fine resolution. But pretty much what happens is that if that shark moves somewhere else, I won't know, okay, unless I'm in contact with someone else who has another receiver somewhere else, and that receiver picks the signal from my sharks, okay? So this IMOS network I'm telling you guys about is pretty much this huge collaboration all around Australia, and everyone just downloads their data and just put it there. And what that means is that you just increase the coverage of your study, right? So if you're tagging your animals here, and that's not only for sharks, okay? So there's people tagging crabs, sea lions, sea snakes, so a whole bunch of different marine animals there. And it's a very nice collaboration. So that's pretty much the acoustic receivers, okay? So that's like you need to tag the animal and you need the receivers so you know exactly where which animal was, okay? But when we talk about the satellite tags, that's much finer resolution, which means that you're just following the animals around. So it doesn't matter where they go, you will know where they went, okay? And the main difference between spot and PSATs is that spot tags, we need the animal to come to the water surface so that the tag has a salinity sensor. So when the animal puts the fin out of the water, so we usually put these tags on the dorsal fin of the sharks. So every time the shark breaks the water surface with its fin, the tag knows that it's out of the water, so it connects to the satellite, okay? So I don't know if you guys know, but like these things, they need to be out of the water so they can connect and communicate with the satellites, okay? So they can't communicate with the satellites if they're underwater. So every time the animal pops up at the water surface, we get a location from it, okay? Whereas the PSATs, it's pretty much a data logger. So it's gonna collect environmental luminosity data during its deployment. And for example, we put these things and we program them to pop up after, say, 3 months. Okay, so for 3 months, you won't hear from it. And after the 3 months, it detaches from the animal, comes to the water surface, and then it sends the data to the satellite. So we know where the animal went, okay? So the spot tag is pretty much a satellite real-time transmitter, whereas the PSATs, you won't hear from them until the deployment is finished.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That was such a great summary. I've talked about this before. I would love to use spot tags on seven gills, but they never reach the surface. So I can't, those are just like automatically disqualified for me. Yeah. But I eventually want to try to use those pop-up satellite tags.
Yeah. Yeah. It also depends on the biology of the species you're working. And for example, PSATs also be aware, for example, you need to sometimes turn off some of the sensors. So these tags, for example, they don't know what's going on, okay? And by default, if it just sits at the bottom for too long, it's gonna think that the animal is dead and detach. But sometimes it's just because the animal likes to remain still for a long time. So that can mess up your study as well.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Nobody put that on a nurse shark because it'll just think they're dead.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know that.
I didn't either.
You just turn it off.
Wow. I didn't know that.
That is funny.
So in terms of environmental variables, why is daily remote sensing data of sea surface temperature and chlorophyll A concentration important when we're considering these marine predator movements?
Yeah, so as I was saying before, right? So these animals, most of them, they don't control their body temperatures. So they need to follow where the temperatures that they like are going so they can maintain their physiology at the optimum level, okay? And that's for temperature. But also temperature is also influencing where the food is going. So we know that not only sharks, but like turtles and other fish like mesopredators, they're moving because of changing water temperatures. So the sharks are kind of like not only following the temperature gradients, but also following where their prey is going to. And that's where chlorophyll A comes into place as well, because like chlorophyll A, we're talking about productivity, right? So the sharks won't feed on microalgae, but the microalgae blooms that we can detect with chlorophyll A will be important for aggregations of fish and other marine animals, like lower trophic levels, and the sharks can detect these pulses of of productivity so they can get there. Okay, so we in our study, we found a lag of a couple of days. So it's not that, look, you have a bloom of chlorophyll A today and the sharks will get there. But they will get there after a couple of days because they will follow the signals from their prey.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you also mentioned in your materials and methods that cloud coverage was an issue at some points. And is that because the remote sensing data or the satellites couldn't see the sea surface temperature? Or yes. Why was cloud coverage? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So we're talking about a very big data set here, right? It's not only big temporally, but also spatially. So we're talking about an area between Papua New Guinea, Tasmania, and west to the Solomon Island, which is like very, very big. I can't remember exactly the area from the top of my head, but it's huge. So that by itself, it comes with a lot of caveats. Because, for example, I killed one computer trying to process this data because it's just too much data. Yeah. So cloud coverage, I had to download cloud coverage data between 2002 and 2020 for every day in the entire area. Okay.
Oh my gosh, that's so much.
Yeah.
Is your computer okay?
Well, actually, I have a much better computer now, so it was actually for the best.
But, oh my gosh.
But yeah, that's the problem with when you look at things with daily resolution and you're using remote sensing data, sometimes you get these gaps because the satellite cannot see the water surface because of cloud coverage. So when we have these kind of issues, we just calculate a weekly mean. So depending on the database you're using, these weekly means, they're already calculated for you. Sometimes you need to download the daily data and just calculate the means for each quadrat of latitude and longitude. So you know that, like, for example, the average temperature there this day, you have a gap because of cloud, but then tomorrow you will have a value, and then the next day you're going to have another value. So you can just calculate the average between these three, for example, if you want to use a three-day mean, for example. So that reduces the amount of gaps because you're using data from different days in the same area, okay? So this is one of the strategies of getting rid of these gaps. And to be honest, the temperature, I'm not sure about other variables, like, for example, current speed, that might be more variable. But for temperature, it doesn't change much from one day to the other. So it's fine to use average values.
Oh, that's nice. Cool. Okay, so you have all of this data about the chlorophyll, and you get all the gaps filled in from when there's cloud coverage, and you have this movement data, and then you started to model how these animals were moving around. And so you included a lot of different variables into this statistical model to see how they might, so you could predict how they might move in the future. And you used variables such as class-specific patterns, meaning if they were juveniles or adults. You also used variables for their habitat preferences and vertical movements within the region. So I wondered if you can explain why this might vary between class, like what biological factors are at play here?
Yeah, so it was actually very interesting to see that it did vary. So yeah, as you guys said earlier, most of studies, when you look at how animals move, that's usually at species level and sometimes at age classes, right? So we have how the juveniles move in comparison to the adults, and sometimes we have males in comparison to the females. But this is really, like, to my knowledge at least, this was really the first study to look at how these things vary between sexes and between age classes, okay? So because we had this great data set, we could actually look at these things with finer detail. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough adult males, so we had to remove them from our analysis. But it was really interesting to see how these patterns did vary between each of these groups. So for example, between juvenile males and juvenile females, we did saw different trends. And that might be related, for example, to region-specific abundance of one of these groups. So imagine if females, we saw that the females, they have a more strict temperature range around the 22 degrees. So that might mean that they kind of like particular areas. So they might be more abundant in these areas. So if you have like a juvenile male going into an area where there's a lot of juvenile females, we talk about interspecific competition. So they might go, oh, okay, so I might just, you know, find a better place for myself. And we saw that they can be quite tolerant to lower temperatures as well. So, and that's probably what's also explaining why they were the group that was predicted to be occurring along the coast of Tasmania in the future, more pronouncedly than the other groups. And it was actually quite interesting after we published this paper, I posted about it on Twitter, and a guy from Tasmania, he sent me a picture of a tiger shark caught in Tasmania. And he said, look, it's already happening. He said it was the first tiger shark he caught there, by the way.
Wow. So when you're making these models, how do you decide what is important to include in them versus not, right? Because it's, I would guess, super hard to make a model that is 100% accurate to our planet because you're missing things like currents, for example. How do you decide what is important to make your model as applicable to real life as possible?
Yeah, so it's really important to choose variables that are going to influence the animal somehow, that we know that they do influence. So, for example, we know that tiger shark movements are related to temperature. So not only tiger sharks, sharks in general, okay? So that's an important factor to consider, okay? We know that chlorophyll might also influence because that's going to influence where the prey is going to be because they're predators, right? So they're following their prey. And the other thing that we did, we also compared the movements of different prey species. So species of turtles, species of fish, species of other sharks because tiger sharks, they eat other sharks, and species of rays, and also seabirds. So we compared all of those different species distributions to the different biological classes. And we did see that some classes of sharks were more related to one or another species of prey. And the reason for that, again, is competition. Okay, so imagine these guys are occurring in the same area. So they might target different species so they can reduce competition and they can coexist. So when we first think about parameters that do influence predators somehow, and then we include all of these variables in the model, and the algorithm itself is gonna compare the movements of sharks to the gradients of all of these variables that we know that might influence them, and the model itself selects which are the best variables for which group of sharks in this paper, okay? So it's an algorithm, okay? It's not me, Yuri, saying, okay, so this is the best variable, okay? So it's a whole bunch of statistical analysis that actually take into account all of these factors that we think might be affecting shark distribution, and the model itself, the algorithm tells us, okay, so this is important. And also it tells us how much is this important, okay? So there is a percentage there as well. So that percentage also varies between the different biological groups. So for example, the model can be more accurate for adult females and less accurate for juvenile females. So that can also depend on how many individuals from each group you tagged, but also how strong the effect between what the animals are doing and what the environment is looking like. So how strong these relationships are, really.
I don't do any sort of modeling work for my PhD research, so thank you for answering that, because I honestly didn't know what the answer was.
I'm just like literally tried to start modeling today and I almost broke my brain trying to do it. So yeah, I'm at the very beginning of a very uphill climb.
Yeah, just keep going. You'll get there, I know.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the confidence. So something that I was like really shocked by, and I think you kind of touched on for a second, was that there were so few mature adult males. Do you know why this was? There was only 5 adult males that you tagged this entire data set?
Yeah, so since this was a collaboration between different university projects and government agencies, so we're talking about mitigation programs of risk of shark bites. So these things, they operate in very coastal waters, so in very proximity to the beach, okay? So that's kind of like related to that, okay? So it's not that like we don't have many adult males, it's just simply because we believe they're in other places. So for example, there is this island called, I just forgot the name, what is it called again? Yeah, I can't remember the name, but it's in the Coral Sea region. And we know that there are heaps of adult males there. So what we're doing in our most recent project is we're targeting these places so we can tag more adult males. Okay.
All right. So I think that pretty well summarizes our materials and methods there. So let's jump into the results.
So you found that tiger sharks' movements were influenced by the chlorophyll A concentration and also optimal sea surface temperature, where juvenile females in southern regions associated between 22 to 23 degrees Celsius, and adult females 18 to 22, and juvenile males 19 to 22 were associated with cooler waters. I guess this question also kind of plays into your models, but do you think that the mating of them between males and females might be occurring at very specific latitudes longitudes just based on their preference for different locations?
Yeah, it could be, or it could be that just go somewhere to breed. Like, we know that these guys, they can remember certain places, okay?
Right.
So tiger sharks, they're not very much, they don't have that much site fidelity as we see in other species. So for example, bull sharks, I also studied bull sharks since my master's. And we know that the bull sharks, they come back to the same estuaries every reproductive cycle to give birth to their juveniles. So it's kind of like what we see with the turtles, you know, that they go back to the same beach they were born to have their babies. So some species of sharks, they do that. And with tiger sharks, could be that they're just going to the same spots to breed, for example. And also, we need to think that like different biological groups, they depend on temperature for different things as well. So we know that in some species of sharks, for example, blue sharks off the coast of Brazil. So I'm Brazilian originally. So we know that they breed in the southern part of Brazil, so in colder waters. And the females, they have this organ where they can store the semen. And they don't really, they don't really get pregnant straight away. So they just copulate there, and then they move north to warmer waters. So the metabolism is going to be quicker and use less energy to form their offspring. So when they're there, they get pregnant. It's kind of like these we're talking about kind of some super machines here, really.
Yeah.
So we don't know exactly why they're related to these different thermal windows, but we think that these relationships might have to do with biological things, with physiological things, and also related, for example, to which prey they kind of prefer to eat. And that prey might be more related to one of these different gradients.
That is so cool. I just like had like 10 questions shot off in my mind as you were talking about that. Do you think that tiger sharks or other species of sharks could adapt kind of quickly if they're able to mate in certain areas and delay pregnancy, do you think that would help them or give them an advantage during climate change? If the temperature of the water isn't ideal, they could just hold on to that sperm until they were ready to reproduce?
Well, I can't tell you for sure because I don't know exactly how long they can store their sperm for. And sometimes, we're talking about climate change, but climate change is not this continuum of temperature increase. Okay, so we have years that the temperature gets very warmer than what it was supposed to be, and then other years it actually goes down and then it goes up again. So it fluctuates quite a lot, you know, and also depends on the species reproductive cycle. So some species, they reproduce every year, others every two years, others even every 3 years. So I'm not sure how long that might be, but you might be right, you know, because maybe they can store this semen for longer. Yeah, who knows? Well, they have been around for 450 million years, so I'm sure they'll find a way.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. I hope so. Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Do you know how many other species are able to do that? Because I don't think I knew that as a shark adaptation.
I'm not sure. I'm not even sure if tiger sharks do that. I'm just guessing here from what we know about blue sharks.
Sure.
That might be the case.
Oh, so cool. Okay, and then just really quickly, because this came up a few times in your paper and I wasn't sure, what are isobaths and why are they important?
So isobaths are pretty much just depth gradients. So when we talk about moving to shallower isobaths or lower isobaths, we're talking about animals moving closer to the coast, so shallower waters. And deeper isobaths mean that they're moving into oceanic habitats. So that's isobaths is actually a synonym for depth.
Got it. Thank you.
No worries.
So one of the main takeaways appears to be the tiger sharks and other marine predators will begin to move polewards. Can you help us describe to listeners what this means and why does it matter to our coastline if sharks are no longer persistent?
Yeah, so this doesn't really mean that sharks are no longer persistent, right? I think it's more that they're just moving and spending more time somewhere else, okay? And again, as we found in the paper, that might vary within a species. So that might be that some tiger sharks, we expect the females to remain further north, but becoming more frequent further south along the east coast of Australia, whereas the males are expected to actually shift, okay? So it's not that they will disappear from the north, okay? And what that means is that, as I said earlier, look, the other animals are already shifting south, okay? So we know, for example, imagine that sea turtles are moving and spending more time further south. So sea turtles, they're herbivores, right? So they're going to eat algae and they're going to eat these habitats that are important, for example, for some species of fish when they're larvae. So if you don't have sharks there to control the populations of turtles, that means that those species of fish that depend on algae and cnidarians, for example, for their early life stages, they might be impacted, okay? So the sharks, by moving further south and preying on these guys that are already being found there, they're gonna help control the balance of the marine ecosystem. And that's, again, one of the big importances of sharks for marine environments, and one that people really need to be aware of. Because a lot of people are afraid of sharks and don't really understand how important they are to keep the balance and the health of the marine system.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that if they move polewards, I know you said that they will still be persistent and it can be very individual, but do you anticipate at some point that near the equator, we will just have much less persistence of sharks?
Yeah, I think not only of sharks, but of other life. Animals as well.
Yeah.
For example, benthic animals that they pretty much depend on their larvae stages to follow the currents so they can move somewhere else. But the ones that are already further north, they will die. And I really think that in the future, if we don't really do anything about climate change to actually change this, we're going to have big deserts around tropical areas. And the temperate areas where sometimes are not that much abundant in life, they will become the new tropical areas. And really, we're looking at a kind of like an expanding desert, right? As we see already in some parts of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So some species of coral are like every year more and more coral die in the Great Barrier Reef. And that's really sad because like unless we do something about climate change to really change this, we're really talking about seeing big deserts in otherwise very rich marine areas.
Yeah, so keep those sharks alive and also let's keep working on climate change because I don't want to see that happen for sure.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, that's really sad, isn't it?
So you mentioned that if tiger sharks shift to other habitats, they may start competing with white sharks and seven-gill sharks. I wonder if you could elaborate on what you think about these as competitive interactions and what these interactions might look like, specifically for seven-gills, because selfishly, I'm studying them, and I think that interaction is really cool.
Yeah, sure. So we're talking about species that are more temperate than tiger sharks, right? So again, as I said earlier, when we think about a distribution of a species and how temperature is related to that, some species, they might target similar prey, but they live in different areas because the temperature is different, right? So when we think about seven-gill and white sharks around the east coast of Australia, they are not that much common further north, although we've seen some whites moving to Indonesia. but they're more often further south, the east coast of Australia. Okay, so we're talking about species that were separated in the past because their temperature ranges did not overlap that much. But they do eat similar stuff. Okay, so maybe we think about adult tiger sharks and like juvenile white sharks and adult seven-gill sharks. We're really talking about animal predators that will be eating similar stuff. By eating similar stuff, if they start overlapping in space because temperatures are shifting and like allowing tiger sharks to go to areas where seven gills and white sharks were more often, they might start competing for food, okay? So again, this is gonna depend, and like this is just speculation here, because even though they overlap in space because temperature allow them to do so, they might actually segregate temporarily. So let's say tiger sharks will be on the same places where seven gills, but seven gills will start arriving there after the tigers leave, for example. Yeah. Or tiger sharks, because they're often more oceanic, right? It's not that often that we see tiger sharks close to the coast. So the seven gills might segregate in space with tigers, but really we're talking about animals that eat similar stuff and that competition might be not allowed by climate change, right? So one of the comments that we had when this paper was under review was that I was kind of saying, yeah, climate change is impacting sharks. And one of the reviewers made a very nice and intelligent comment that it's actually not really talking about impact here, right? So when we think about, yeah, how we humans impact animals, and we say, yeah, we're impacting them. But in this case, if I was a tiger shark, I'd say, yeah, bring on climate change, because now I can go further and to new areas where I couldn't in the past. So really, we're talking about expanding the habitats of one species and increasing overlap with more temperate species. And yeah, we need more research in the future to actually see how these guys will adapt to coexist.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's going to be so cool. We don't have tiger sharks over on my coastline near San Francisco to compete, but we do have white sharks. And I'm very curious about the competitive interactions between white sharks and seven gills. I think could be really cool to look at in terms of overlap. Yeah.
Well, you don't have tiger sharks yet.
Yeah.
No, yeah, that's true. Not yet. Oh, my gosh.
Who knows?
You never know. Oh, my gosh.
We reached the end of our questions. You did a really good job of answering our questions and also answering questions that we hadn't even asked yet. So we don't want to be repetitive and ask you ones that you'd already answered while answering other questions. Was there anything that we didn't touch on from your article that you want us to touch on now?
Questions were great, actually. I mean, there's a lot of modeling stuff here. We just bore people to death.
I always think modeling is good to talk about, but really hard to like
actually
make interesting on a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed.
Well, like it's just the tool, really.
Yeah, right?
It's just the tool that we use to tell us the patterns that we're looking after.
Yeah, totally. Well, we've reached our favorite part of the podcast where we ask you for a field story. So do you have an experience in the field that is just, you know, funny or anecdotal or inspiring or something that you don't usually get to share otherwise in a science setting? We would love to give you some space to tell us about your favorite field experience.
Yeah, because, like once we caught up. So, part of my PhD was looking at bull sharks movements inside Sydney Harbour. So every summer, bull sharks, they go to Sydney. They move south from the Great Barrier Reef and they come to Sydney every summer and autumn. And because we know they're there, so we go fishing for them, right? Because we increase the chances of actually catching one and tagging them. So we were fishing for bull sharks inside Sydney Harbour late at night, like at 3 a.m. Because like Sydney Harbour is very, very busy, you know. We have lots of ferries and like recreational and fishing, like, recreational fishing boats. So that can be really, really busy. And one night we were fishing for bull sharks and we caught something like, we used... I don't know if people know this, but to get a sample and to tag a shark, you need to fish.
Yes.
You need to go fishing for them. So we put like a couple of hooks in the water, which are called long line. So the long line is pretty much this long cable with several hooks along this cable. Okay. So in this case, we're talking about 10 hooks. So I'm pulling this cable myself. And yeah, no sharks, I take the hook off. I pull the cable and yeah, no sharks, take the hook off. And I keep going, and then the line was just dead flat. And I was like, yeah, I think this thing's just stuck somewhere. And like in Sydney Harbour, we use a very small boat. So it's really, really a very, very tiny metal boat with a very small engine. And like, I'm trying to pull this thing up and it's just impossible. You know? I'm like, yeah. I don't know, maybe we caught a ray and the ray is just sitting there at the bottom, you know? And I tell my supervisor, hey, Vic, I think we this thing's just, you know, entangled, or we caught a ray maybe. And I suggest maybe I can put the line around this hook. We have this big hook on the side of our boat. So I said, yeah, maybe I can put the hook, the line around the hook, and you can, you know, go backwards a little bit so we can try and disentangle this thing. He said, yeah, great idea, do that. So I put the line around the hook and Vic start moving the boat backwards, and then suddenly the line start moving and dragged us on our side. So literally our boat was on its side, like, you know, in the Jaws movie with the shark. Oh. And we're like, fuck. We caught a white shark, you know, because like, we never caught a white shark inside Sydney Harbour before. But I mean, like, it's a big estuary and like the salinity is good for them. So there's no reason really for not having a white shark inside there. But we never caught one. And we really thought it was a white shark because it was like dragging the boat on its side for a couple of seconds. But then the line started moving, you know, and started pulling it up. And it was me, Vic, and two other people on the boat. And the four of us start, you know, pulling the line. And then we saw this massive bull shark, like 3.5, 3.6 meters. Like, it was really, really big. But it was a bull shark, not a white. But it was really cool.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that is cool. I mean, a big shark is a big shark, regardless of if it's a white shark or not.
I've heard of that happening with small boats, where, like, the shark is big enough and strong enough, because it's not like they're weak animals, that they just straight up start pulling the boat.
Yeah, you know. And, like, I mean, I've handled tiger sharks before. And they're usually not not aggressive, I would say. Like, they don't fight that much, the tigers, yeah, I think.
I agree with that statement.
But the bulls are very, very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never caught a white shark on the line before. But comparing bulls and tigers, the bulls are much harder to work than tigers.
Yeah. When we use drum lines and long lines. And a lot of times we catch the bulls and the tigers on our drum lines. So when we're reeling them in, the tigers will kind of just, like, follow you. They almost seem lazy. Like, you can just kind of pull them.
Yeah.
And then the bull sharks are, like, insane and decide that they want to swim in all these crazy directions. And on top of that, they're super strong. And so the actual feeling for me of reeling both of those in is a completely different experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you know which shark I hate the most to handle is the nurse shark.
Yes. Horrendous.
You just validated Amani so much.
Yeah, like, they just keep spinning and you know, like, entangling themselves in the line, and you get like, just stop. I want to free you.
And it's insane. They are the most ridiculous sharks to reel in.
And because their mouth is so inferior, it's so hard to cut the hook.
Yes, it is. You really have to, like, get up in there and also not get sucked into their mouth or chomped by their mouth because they're so strong. Yeah, they're insane.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us. We've so enjoyed learning more about tiger sharks, especially in Australia. I think this might be our first episode focusing on an Australian population. So thank you so much. Cool. And where can our sharkies follow you?
So, yeah, I post most of my work on Twitter. So at @Yuri_Niela with double L and Yuri with Y.
Awesome. All right. We'll make sure to put all of your, we'll make sure to put your Twitter handle in our show notes so people can give you a follow. Awesome. Thank you so much again. And until next time,
swim you later.
Thank you so much.